Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. This is part two of our exciting interview with Nina Teicholz. The Big Fat Surprise is her new book. It's taking the country by storm. You've seen her on TV. You've seen her book reviewed in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. I think it even spawned a cover story on Time magazine about the reversal of our thinking about what we once thought was the harmful nature of saturated fat and cholesterol. The subtitle of her book, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. And so, you know, a little bit of, some caveats about this. Some people who are proponents of a high-protein, low-carb diet say that there are some pitfalls to eating lots of meat and dairy. And primarily, the pitfalls are not inherent in the fat qualities or the cholesterol qualities of eggs and dairy and meat, but what is accompanied, what comes along with those foods because of the way that we raise cattle, the way that we use hormones, antibiotics, pesticides, and so on, and that works its way into the meat, it works its way into the dairy products, the eggs, and that therefore these types of foods may be a Trojan horse for some environmental chemicals or undesirable drugs that have found their way into the food chain. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that there are really legitimate concerns about meat and dairy products from a number of perspectives that are environmental, ethical, questions of how humanely and well those products are raised. My aim in my book, which it was just to ask and answer the question, what is healthy for human beings? Is a high carbohydrate diet healthier? Is a high, what will help us stem these incredible tide of chronic disease from which we are now suffering, the obesity and diabetes crisis, the failure to solve the heart disease epidemic? I just wanted to ask the question of what is good for health. After that, and that took me almost a decade of reading all the research. I think the questions that flow from there, are, okay, how can we raise that food sustainably and in an ethical way? But the first question to really ask and to try to get consensus on is, what is healthy? We don't even agree on that. You know, our nutrition experts are ratcheting back the saturated fat that they recommend for fighting heart disease, that they're ratcheting back that level ever further. So there's a huge chasm now in the nutrition world about what even constitutes a healthy diet. Let's first agree on that, and then we can get to the issues of how to make that sustainable.
And then, you know, this argument is by no means settled, even though it's now at the center of a media blitz, you know, with a lot of people saying, oh, saturated fat is now okay, and eggs are okay, and meat's okay, because you still have the stalwarts. You have the Dean Ornishes of the world who, you know, they have science on their side. They've demonstrated through an ultra-restricted vegan diet, and if you hold hands and meditate and do exercise, that you can reverse heart disease with that type of diet. So is there no place for vegetarianism or for a non- very low-fat diets in prevention of heart disease?
Well, I think vegetarians might be surprised at how slender the evidence base is for the healthiness of that diet. I mean, Dean Ornish's foundational study was on 21 men, and actually the mortality was not reduced by his diet, and even if he could show regression in plaque, which is, you know, just the presence of plaque is not a reliable predictor of your actual heart attack risk.
Right. There's a little bit of a disconnect between just the appearance of plaque and whether you're going to live or die.
Right. You know, it turns out it's the unstable kind of plaque that ruptures and clogs the arteries that is the culprit in heart attack. So it's not just that there's a kind of natural progression of plaque that happens in a lot of people that doesn't necessarily cause heart attacks or death. But let's just, even accepting his claims that he is possibly reversing heart disease, is it due to the nutrition? Is it due to the meditation? Is it due to the supplements? So, he's got a multifactorial approach on, again, a tiny sample of men. And so that's really rather a slender evidence base. There's another diet doctor called Esselton, who's very much in the news. Mm-hmm. He did another tiny study.
He's on speed dial to Bill Clinton, apparently. He's very influential.
Dean Ornish, yeah. But, you know, his study, also tiny study of just a couple, you know, maybe two dozen men that was not controlled. There was no control group. I mean, there's really, that's just not the kind of science that you need to make large-scale recommendations. And so, and that's the trial base of evidence. The big epidemiological studies that show, they should show that vegetarians live longer, because vegetarians are the kind of people who care about their health. They do everything right. They go to the doctor. They're people who tend to their health. Those kinds of people should live longer. And in the largest epidemiological studies, it turns out, you know, vegetarians don't live longer, and
right.
They should.
I just reported on that. That was a real surprise, but it kind of blew that myth right out of the water.
Right. So I think that it's possible to be healthy on a vegetarian diet, but it's harder. I mean, just to get back to the point about saturated fat, though, the animal foods are really nutritionally dense. They contain vitamins and minerals that are hard to find, if not impossible to find elsewhere. Vitamin B12, B6 is only in animal foods. Selenium, folate, zinc, iron, exceptionally dense and bioavailable in meat, much harder to find in plant foods. And we've been avoiding these nutritionally dense, healthy foods because we feared the saturated fat in them. But these foods are exceptionally nutritionally dense. They have a perfect balance of protein to fat in them. They have the fat that's needed to absorb the fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, K. So they're great nutritionally rich foods, and we have been avoiding them for reasons that turn out to be not valid.
And do you feel that this is a historical anomaly? Because if we look back at the diet of the average 19th century American or European, until recently, when we developed this low-fat mania, we pretty much were consuming an omnivorous diet. And actually, there was less in the way of cancer, heart disease, and degenerative diseases.
Well, so yeah, one of the things that I do is go back and look at the historical evidence. And there's actually some very rigorous historical analyses of what Americans used to eat. They used to eat in the 1700s, 1800s, 3 to 4 times more red meat than we do today. We ate 3 to 4 times more butter, 5 to 6 times more lard. I mean, butter and lard were the only fats used by American housewives until 1900, when vegetable oils started creeping in, and that was before the epidemics of heart disease and obesity and diabetes.
And my ancestors subsisted on something called schmaltz,
right.
which is the Eastern European version of lard.
Chicken fat.
And they prized it. It was like, what do you mean, you know, take the skin off the chicken? You know, collect the lard collect the chicken fat and spread it on your bread, because that's a good source of nutrition.
Well, many cultures prized the fat. You know, the fattiest parts of the animal were eaten first, and you know, the Inuit were actually fed the tenderloin, which we think is the best cut of meat. They fed the tenderloin to the dogs because it just wasn't lean enough. You know, mm-hmm. They prized the fat on the back and the fat, you know, the fat behind the eyes of the animal. I mean, it was so different than the way that it seems like a foreign species to us. It's
right.
So different than the way we think today.
And I go back to my Yiddish heritage, and there's this word gribenitz, which is it's the tail of the chicken, you know, where that, you know, that fatty tail that was supposed to be the ultimate delicacy, and you certainly didn't cut it off and, you know, get rid of it. They, you know, and so often you hear this invocation, you know, trim the fat very carefully off the meat, you know, eat skinless, you know, chicken breast. And, you know, that's really become a mantra in America, that's the key to healthy eating.
Yeah, I mean, food is tasteless without fat. And the fat is what gives it the flavor. It's essential to cooking. And And it used to be that meat that was too lean was seen as worthless, and the Inuit actually had a term they called for rabbit starvation when they were starving and they couldn't get their normal, their diet of caribou or salmon or eggs. They would have to subsist on rabbit, which is an exceptionally lean meat, and they suffered all kinds of ill symptoms because the meat was too lean. So it's kind of mind-boggling now. I mean, over the last, because all of our industries have responded to the clarion call by the U.S. government to produce low-fat foods. So the entire beef industry and has produced lower-fat animals because, you know, that literally just don't produce the level of fat that they used to have because, I mean, the whole food industry has moved towards low-fat foods.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the low-fat yogurt, the low-fat ice cream, and so on. And yeah, there's also some satiety issues with low-fat foods. Can you explain that? You know, why that might be counterproductive? It's sort of like that episode of Seinfeld where they just couldn't stop eating that low-fat yogurt. It didn't have any calories. And so but then they started noticing that, you know, George was getting fat and, you know.
Right. That was basically me as a teenager, that whole scene.
Right.
But, so, you know, foods that are high in fat and protein are naturally satiating. So in overfeeding experiments that were done in the 1960s, they put stacks of pork chops in front of inmates and said, eat these. And the men said, we cannot. We just cannot. You cannot overeat on meat. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's very easy to overeat on carbohydrates like, you know, cookies, crackers, popcorn. And there's something about fat and protein, I don't think that's really known, that just fill you up. Your cells, maybe it's because your cells are getting something essential that they truly need. And they send the message up to your brain, I'm not hungry anymore. And a diet high in fat, I mean, the so-called Atkins diet, there's no need to restrict calories on that diet because people simply don't overeat on it naturally. Whereas people overeat on a high carbohydrate diet. So, you know, actually it's fascinating. In head-to-head diet trials where they pit the Atkins diet against the low-fat mm-hmm. diet or the Dean Ornish diet, the low-fat diet, they mandate a limit on calories, but they never do for the Atkins diet because it's just implicitly known people will not overeat on that.
Well, reiterate a point that you made earlier in part one. It's often contended, well, yeah, sure, you know, you can lose weight on these types of diets because, you know, you're eating so much fat and protein, you kind of get nauseated, you don't want to eat, so you end up losing weight. But it's going to kill you. That's actually the contention of a lot of people. They'll acknowledge that, okay, you know, some of these studies show short-term gains, but you're going to die. What's the evidence that that's not the case? Have they done enough long-term studies?
Right. Well, yeah, I remember a column by Dean Ornish which said, you know, eat for health, not for weight. But, of course, obesity is intimately linked with these other chronic diseases like heart disease and diabetes. If you're obese, you're more likely to get these other diseases. But, again, a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet, there have been numerous rigorous clinical trials over the last decade that have really tested that diet and found that it is better not only for losing weight, but also for your risk factors, your markers, biomarkers for diabetes and heart disease. So that diet turns out to be a diet that helps with health and weight.
Mm-hmm. So
you don't have to choose. You don't have to eat for weight, not health, right. Or health, not weight. You can get them both.
Right. We don't want to. We don't want to turn out skinny corpses.
Right. I mean, you know, and it makes sense because carbohydrates, especially of the refined kind, they cause a metabolic disorder that produces obesity, which is the same, and it's also the common. It's also what causes diabetes and heart disease. There are just, you know, these all have the common source. That's why those diseases occur together. They cluster. That's why we have something called metabolic syndrome, which describes the clustering of all those symptoms that come out of eating excessive carbohydrates.
Well, so you've been on the circuit for what now? A month or so since this book has been out. By the way, the book is an explosive success, a real bestseller. Congratulations, you've really gotten the word out because you've articulated this beautifully. And you follow in the tradition of individuals like Gary Taubes, who's also a pioneer in getting this message across. He's also an investigative journalist, but you tell the story beautifully in a very compelling and fascinating way that I think can be accessible to a lot of people. So you've been on a lot of TV shows. You've been reviewed in the Times and the Wall Street Journal and hither and thither and yon. What's been the reception? There's been some pushback. Have you got any death threats? Have you gotten pushback from people who, like this doctor at NYU, think that you're just teeing off on a reasonable diet?
I also thought that I was going to be pelted with cabbages. And when I walked out the door, I happened to live in a block in New York City between a vegan grocery store and two vegan restaurants. And but the reception has been surprisingly warm. Like, I was actually on a show with a Cleveland cardiologist who, to my great surprise, said, I agree with Nina. And I think that's because the message about fat and even saturated fat has been circling around out there. And it just, I've put everything, all the arguments together in one place. And maybe we're at a tipping point. What we need now is a movement of like parents for whole milk for children or something to make this a more popular issue. But I've had surprisingly little pushback. I mean, I've of course had Dean Ornish say that he thinks my book is a dangerous book, and there will be, I'm sure, opposition down the line. But I think that people are ready for this message. It's also true that since Gary Taubes, who is the father of this whole field of research and is an exceptional science journalist, there has been a huge kind of underground movement of low carbohydrate, paleo, whatever you want to call them. There's own magazine, there's many, many blogcasts, there's tons of websites, and there's a kind of underground movement despite the fact that our nutrition experts are still wed to a low fat diet. There's an underground swell there that is lively and burgeoning and ready for an alternative book, I guess, or alternative viewpoint.
Well, there's a big initiative to improve the diet of Americans, particularly focused on improving the diet of kids. Do you think Washington is lagging behind in terms of its understanding of the true nutritional underpinnings of obesity? Are you happy with the recommendations that are being made for children's food, or do you think it needs to be revamped?
Well, I would like to see this movement of parents for whole milk, because when the low-fat diet recommendations were expanded to include children, this is basically nutritional advice that had been developed for middle-aged men to fight heart disease, and then children were just roped, they were just looped into that, and there was no data on children.
It's by extrapolation, it's not by experimental evidence, it's just an extrapolation.
There was no evidence.
Yeah.
And there were plenty of pediatricians who said, who is to say that the needs of the octogenarian are the same as the growing child? There was a lot of opposition to including children. But and when they were finally tested, decades after they had been told to follow the low-fat diet, it turns out that children on the low-fat diet suffer nutritional deficiencies. And children, growth in children is better on the level of fat that Americans used to eat, which is about 40% fat. Children they grow better on that amount of fat compared to the 25 to 35% of fat that they've been told to consume. So, children especially need whole foods with whole fats in them. I mean, you can, for example, whole milk. The school lunch program mandates that milk be 2% or less.
Yeah.
But you need the fat in milk to absorb the fat-soluble vitamins A and D. And then without those vitamins, you can't absorb the minerals in milk. So, children should be having whole fat milk. I think But, you know, all of these recommendations flow from the dietary guidelines that are issued by the USDA, and it's nothing is going to change until those guidelines are reconsidered.
And they're basing them on obsolete science.
Well, that's basically right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, so, look, I mean, it's good. You know, we're making an effort, but we, unfortunately, monolithic organizations like the USDA, the government, you know, the food industry, they move very slowly, and it's like turning around the Queen Mary. It's going to take a long time for the right messages to be ultimately implemented. So what's today's call to action, our intelligent medicine call to action? Is you've got a website. It's great. It's thebigfatsurprise.com. What can listeners find there?
It's basically just a website for my book. There are book reviews. There's my media. There is my cholesterol test, which I had done for Nightline, where I went to have my cholesterol tested to show. And
oh, by the way, what's your cholesterol? You know, you're eating this diet that's like, you know, you're eating lots of butter and fat and steak. And so what is your cholesterol?
Right. I should be a nutritionist nightmare, which is the way that Dr. Atkins' diet has been described by the American Diabetic
Association. You should be on your last legs. Yeah, you should be ready to check out. So what is it?
Well, I don't remember the exact numbers. I mean, everything looks fantastic. Okay. You can watch the Nightline piece, and, you know, my HDL is high, and I actually had a panel that included the more, the best up-to-date measures like LDL particle number and LDL cholesterol size, which are better predictors of risk, and those also look good. So my doctor just said, whatever you're doing, keep on doing it.
And by the way, if you go to thebigfatsurprise.com, you can see what a high-fat-fed woman looks like. You're the mother of two children, is it?
Yes, I have a 7 and 11-year-old.
And you look fantastic, so certainly no adverse effects, in fact, beneficial effects. Your skin looks great, and you're slim and trim. You know, I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you to divulge your dimensions, but you can see clearly if you go to the website, the Big Fat Surprise, no deleterious effects of the diet.
You know, one important thing to say is, like a lot of very busy working parents, I don't have a lot of time to exercise, and although I would love to exercise more, and I think it's important for health in all kinds of ways, but if you're on a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet, you do not need to exercise like 60 to 90 minutes a day, which is what the U.S. government recommends to lose weight on the low-fat diet, a kind of tacit acknowledgement that that diet really just doesn't work.
That's,
I mean, who has an hour and a half a day to exercise? So, I mean, I await the day I can exercise more, but at the moment I'm staying slim without a lot of exercise.
Well, you're in big demand, and I you know, thank you very much for consecrating some part of your very busy day. I'm sure you're back and forth with lots and lots of interviews because the media is all over this. And thanks to you for imparting this message in such a digestible form. Excuse the pun. I recommend The Big Fat Surprise because it's a great book. And if you're going to only read one diet and health book this year, The Big Fat Surprise should be it. It sets forth in a very clear and cogent and credible fashion the argument against the ultra-low-fat diet and for sensible inclusion of natural dairy, meat, and egg products in our diets. And so I thank you very much. And congratulations.
Well, thank you. It's just been a pleasure talking to you, and thank you for having me on.
Very much my pleasure. Nina Teicholz, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.